book will magically make you good at fighting. That's a disappointment, Jason said, given its literal purpose is to magically make me good at fighting. Like I said, Rufus told him, we'll teach you to understand the difference. With our fists, Gary added, and our knees, elbows, and such. Can I just use the book now, please? Go ahead, Rufus said. Taking a deep breath, Jason reached out and placed a hand on the book. Item, Way of the Reaper, 5 Forms, 1, Iron Rank, Legendary. A magical book detailing the foundational techniques for all 5 forms of the Way of the Reaper. Consumable, skill book. Requirements, ability to use skill books. Effect, imparts Iron Rank techniques of the Way of the Reaper's 5 forms. You are able to use the skill book, Way of the Reaper, 5 Forms, 1. Use, yes, no. Jason stood still, hand on the book, eyes closed. He took another deep breath. Something wrong? Rufus asked. I'm just not rushing this, Jason said. It's a big moment for me. I'll probably go the full Keanu. What does that mean? Farah asked. It means be quiet and let me have my magic kung fu moment. Kung fu is what they call punching people where Jason comes from, right? Gary asked. What's happening? Jory asked, wandering out from the clinic's back door. Jason's about to use a skill book, Farah said. Will everyone please shut up? Jason barked, taking his hand off the book and glaring at the others. Just give him his quiet moment, Rufus said. He won't take the book in as well if he's agitated. That's true, Farah said. Sorry, Jason. Try clearing your mind like you're going to meditate. It might help. Thanks, Jason said. He placed his hand back on the book, closing his eyes. He did as Farah suggested, emptying his mind and calming his emotions.
Do you think he's going to take long?
Shut up, Gary, Farah said.
I'm just wondering if I should grill some more meat.
There was a sizzling sound, followed quickly by a yelp of pain.
What did I say about lava in the yard? Jory asked.
Jason let the sounds drift away, letting only the rhythm of his breathing occupy his mind. He felt his body drift away from the world, floating through nothingness. All sensation left him, except for the leather of the book under his hand. You are about to use skill book, Way of the Reaper, 5 Forms, 1. Use, yes, no. He mentally assented, and the huge book floated up off the chest to hover over Jason's head. The ponderous cover flipped open, and text started rising from the page, disembodied runes turning from black to glowing gold. There was a sizzling sound, like meat on a grill as the text transmuted. The first page of the book turned itself over as the last of its text floated off, and the second page began disgorging its contents into the air. With each page, the process grew faster and faster, the glowing jumble of text in the air forming a thick cloud. Even with the increasing pace at which the pages were beginning to turn, it was taking a long time to make it through the massive tome.
Do skill books normally take this long?
Jory whispered to Farah.
No, they don't, Farah said, although I've never seen a skill book that big before.
The cloud of text kept growing, spreading down until Jason was completely obscured. Finally, the sizzling stopped. They couldn't see the heavy book anymore, but they heard it hit the ground with a thud. The cloud of golden text started darting about like a swarm of angry bees. Within it, they could hear Jason grunting in pain.
Hold on, Rufus called out. Try and last out the whole thing.
Is he all right?
Jory asked.
Using a skill book is strenuous, Farah explained. The more it's trying to teach you, the greater the strain.
People often pass out while using them, Rufus said. But the information isn't passed on as well once they're unconscious. It takes them longer to consolidate what they've learned afterwards.
The cloud shrank over time until they could once again see Jason. He was staggering in place, arms out to keep balance. They watched the golden text diving into his body.
You're doing good,
Gary cheered him on. Hold on as best you can, Rufus encouraged.
Finally, the last of the text sank into Jason, leaving him standing unsteadily, but still upright. He took in a sharp breath.
Whoa,
he croaked.
Still standing, Rufus said. You've done well.
How do you feel?
Farah asked. Jason stood up straight, eyes gleaming in triumph.
I know Kung Fu!
Vomit spewed out of him, and he fell to his knees, coughing up more before toppling onto his side, unconscious.
Is he all right? Jory asked.
For Jason, Gary said. This is actually pretty good.
In the fighting pits of the fortress, two women squared off inside a steel cage. The first was Sophie Wexler, the Nightingale. The other was called the Queen of Thorns, for the thorny whip manifested by her power. It had length enough that no part of the cage was safe, and being a power rather than a weapon, the Queen had devilish control over it. Sophie was cut and bloody from numerous wounds, but the weakness of the whip was its inability to deal critical damage. So long as it failed to ensnare an enemy, it couldn't deal a finishing blow. Sophie's ability was speed. Not only was she fast, but she could run up walls or even over water. She was boxed in by the cage, but she pushed her reflexes to the limit to avoid being entangled. She had suffered lashes, but the whip had never managed to tie her down. Sophie ran up the side of the cage as the whip lashed under her, flipping off and into a kick, but her opponent jumped back out of reach. Having missed the kick, Sophie landed off balance. Seeing her chance, the Queen flung the whip quickly, wrapping it around Sophie's forearm. Grinning triumph at Sophie, she only found resolution on her enemy's face. Too late, she realized she'd been baited. Sophie shifted her seemingly unbalanced stance, bracing her weight and yanking on the whip with both arms. The Queen stumbled forwards, and Sophie ducked behind, looping the slack whip around the Queen's neck to choke her with her own power. The Queen dismissed the whip, and Sophie acted quickly before the Queen had a chance to conjure it up again. Sophie swept the Queen's unbalanced feet out from under her, grabbed her by the hair, and smashed her face into the floor. The hard earth floor of the fortress was practically stone, and Sophie smashed the Queen's face into it a second time and a third, over and over, until there was a sharp crack and the Queen's body went limp. Skin painted red, silver hair matted with sweat and blood, Sophie left the cage without looking back.
Your winner, ladies and gentlemen, the Nightingale!
Three viewing boxes, normally empty in the early afternoon, all had occupants watching Sophie's match. In one was Cole Silver, the newest member of the Big Three crime lords of Old City. With his father's passing, the old man's protection could no longer keep Sophie from his grip. Just as he had been closing his fingers around her, she had run to Clarissa Ventress. Now Ventress had Sophie fighting ever more dangerous opponents. There was every chance she would be ruined before he could snatch her back into his clutches. Watching her bloody form stride away from the cage, he slapped the fruit platter in front of him across the room. In her own viewing box, Clarissa Ventress was happily imagining the look on Silver's face. She was less happy with Sophie's friend, Belinda.
"You can't keep doing this," Belinda said. "You're going to get her killed."
Clarissa sighed, her good mood deflated. She responded to Belinda without deigning to look at her.
"The arrangement," Clarissa said, "was that dear Sophie would help me provoke Silver into the kind of rash action that his father always kept him from making."
She turned her head towards Belinda.
"The form that provocation takes is for me to decide," Clarissa continued. "How Sophie survives is for her to figure out. You filthy—"
Belinda cut herself off as Clarissa's enormous bodyguard stirred. Darnell had the predatory features universal to Leonids, and Belinda took a step back.
"That's what I thought," Clarissa said. "I don't want to hear your pitiful whining again. Go tend to your injured friend."
Belinda desperately wanted to tear a chunk out of Clarissa's throat, but she was not the match of Clarissa or her bodyguard, two of the criminal underworld's rare bronze rankers. She also knew Sophie would be awkwardly applying medicine right now and making a complete mess of it, so she turned and left. The third box, in which the match had been closely viewed, belonged to Lucian Lamprey. Old City might be the territory of the Big Three, but as director of the Magic Society, he might as well have been the sky above them. If nothing else, as a silver ranker, he could personally tear through Old City's strongest enforcers like they were mewling children. Outside Lamprey's viewing box, Cassowary Finn hesitated before knocking on the door. As the son of Lucian's friend and deputy, Pochard, Cassowary had been installed as Lucian's dog's body and normally enjoyed the man's favor. His lack of progress in finding information on the Nightingale had turned that favor on its head. Hoping that was about to be rectified, he knocked on the door.
"Enter," Lucian's voice barked from inside.
Chapter 51 Song of the Nightingale.
"Enter,"
Lucian's voice bellowed, and Cassowary opened the door. Following him in was a nervous-looking, middle-aged man with a balding head and noticeable paunch.
"Cassowary," Lucian said, his forehead creasing into a frown.
Elven features weren't well-suited to malevolence, but Lucian made it work.
"I take it," Lucian said, "that you're showing your face here because you have what I asked for."
"Yes, sir, Mr. Lucian," Cassowary said quickly. "This man is a bookmaker here in the pits and has been for some years. He knows all about the girl."
The middle-aged man visibly gulped as Lucian looked him up and down.
"Name?" Lucian demanded.
"Hubert, sir. They call me Bert the Bookie."
"Not your name, imbecile. The fighter, Nightingale."
"Sorry, sir. Her name's Sophie, sir. Sophie Wexler."
"You just heard Cassowary tell me you knew everything about her, which, for your sake, I very much hope is true. Tell me everything, Bert the Bookie."
"Everything, sir. Yes, sir," Hubert said.
"She wasn't born local, but came over with her father when she was real little-like. This was at the time of the monster surge before last. I remember that's when it was because her father was part of this merchant group, the head of their muscle. Seems they hadn't been doing so well and gambled big on a sailing run during the surge. There's a reason no one sails during a surge, though, and they lost everything. Only a handful made it on some dinghies, including the girl and her old man. She couldn't have been more than 2 or 3 years old."
"He took a little girl out to sea during a monster surge?" Cassowary asked. "What a prick."
"Shut up," Lucian said to Cassowary, then returned his gaze to Hubert. "You, keep talking."
"Well, the merchant group was done," Hubert continued. "No ships, nor even the money for passage back after the surge was over. The girl's old man went to work for Silver, not Cole Silver, who's in charge now, obviously. His old dad, good man, too. Tough, but fair, you know."
"Get on with it."
"Sorry, sir. So the girl's old man could fight, like proper fight, and catches the old man's attention. Does well under Silver Senior for a lot of years, until there's a problem. Silver Junior takes an interest in the girl."
"Hardly a surprise," Lucian says. "He has eyes."
"She is a looker, sir. But she didn't want any part of Silver the Younger, and none could blame her. He'd left more than a few professional women in no state to undertake their profession, if you catch my drift. Old man Silver, he knows what his son is and likes the girl's father, so he tells his son that it's hands off."
"I bet he took that well," Lucian said.
"About how you'd expect, sir, yes. He did as he was told, but didn't make things pleasant for the girl. Got to the point that her father decided to get her out. He just didn't go about it a good way."
"Oh?"
"The father takes out a loan from Silver the Senior, a hefty one, tries to start up his own trade expedition, but even without a monster surge, the man ain't got no luck with the sea."
"Monster attack?"
"Pirates.
was quite the excitement from what I hear. Father and daughter fighting pirates back to back. Managed to fight them off, too, but the father didn't last long after, and neither did the ship. For the second time in her life, the girl arrives at the city in a dinghy, and this time she's got no father and a shipload of inherited debt. She would have been 16, 17 back then. She had an essence her old man had bought, which had just made the debt all the bigger. This was when she started pit fighting. Cassowary contributed.
Shut up, Cassowary, Lucian barked. Carry on, Bert.
Now, I knew the father and daughter going back to when her father was muscle here in the fortress, Hubert said. He was a hard man, no essences, but I'd seen him put down people who had won even two. He never fought in the pits himself, but the fighters showed him nothing but respect. His girl, as it turns out, was even better. Run up walls, fly through the damn air like a bird.
Nightingale, Lucian said.
That's right, Hubert said. She had a good run, took some beatings early on, but she learned fast. Add that to the way she looks, and she got some attention.
She fights for silver?
Lucian asked. She did, back then, for Silver the Elder, Hubert said. He looked out for her, kept his son off her back, which Silver Jr. did not care for. But the old man took a real shine to the girl. Eventually, she gave up the ring, found some other way to pay the old man back. High-end thieving, was what I heard. She had a friend who made the plans and the tools, and she did the second story work.
Then why is she back in the pits? Lucian asked. And who does she fight for now?
That goes back to when old man Silver died, Hubert said. There was talk Silver wasn't going to pass the mantle down to his son, too impulsive, too beholden to his own appetites. Word is, the old man was going to step back and pass it to one of the old guard before he passed, someone who'd respect the old man's treatment of the girl.
But he didn't pass it on to anyone else, Lucian said.
No, he didn't, Hubert agreed. A couple of months ago, the old man went in his sleep. There were rumours, of course, but nothing came of them. Since the old man hadn't said otherwise, the son stepped in. Damn near the first thing he did was go after the girl. As far as I know, she'd almost cleared the old debt, and now it's in the hands of Silver Jr. He made plenty clear the only payment he'll take. She and her friend have a skill set, though, and made themselves scarce, found their way to another of the big three, Clarissa Ventress, cut a deal to protect them from Silver.
So Ventress is making her fight again? Lucian asked.
Word is, she's only doing it to annoy Silver.
What does she get out of that?
The transition from father to son hasn't been smooth for Silver's people, Hubert explained. The old man was stable and reliable, while it's no secret his son is just the opposite. He ousted his father's old guard, put in his own people. That's left a lot of folks uncertain and nervous about Silver's position in the big three. There's been talk about the other two snatching away Silver's territory. Word is, the only reason they haven't moved is they don't want island folk coming down here. Begging your pardon, sir.
So Ventress is using the girl, Lucian said. She wants to make Silver do something stupid.
The big three know better than to rock the boat too hard, Hubert said. They don't want folk like you, sir, coming in and dealing with them.
But if Cole Silver does something loud and impulsive, Lucian said, then Ventress steps in to settle it down. She claims new territory and makes good with the island powers at the same time.
You see it clear, Hubert said. If I might say, sir, you're as smart as I've heard. Lucian laughed.
I usually detest sycophancy, Lucian said.
But I like you, Bert the bookie. He opened a drawer, took a pouch of coins and tossed it to Hubert.
You're a good storyteller, Lucian said. If you come across any others worth telling, you come and find Cassowary here.
Thanking you, sir, I'll be sure and do that.
Hubert departed the viewing box, coin pouch clutched possessively in both hands. That left Lucian and Cassowary alone, the younger man looking nervously at his employer. Lucian glanced at the younger man, his own face unreadable. Cassowary grew increasingly more unnerved as the silence extended.
Adequate,
Lucian said finally, sending relief spilling over Cassowary's face.
I want you to arrange a meeting with Clarissa Ventress.
Can I rely on you for that?
Yes, Mr. Lucian, sir.
Belinda arrived at the Broad Street Clinic to find a notice on the door. It announced that Mr. Tillman wasn't in for the day. Basic medical supplies could be purchased from the reception, and Mr. Asano would be in at the usual times, but strictly for emergency cases. Inside, the waiting room was quite full.
"Sorry, Mr. Asano," she heard Janice, the receptionist, say. "The notice said emergencies only, but of course people ignore it."
"Or can't read," a man said, coming out from the back room. It was the same man who had given Sophie the free ointment. His sharp features and dark, clear eyes looked stern, until a friendly smile lit up his face like a light.
"Who's next, Janice?" he asked. Janice called up a young mother with her son, the man leading them into the back. Belinda then approached the reception desk.
"I'm looking to buy some more ointment and potions," Belinda told Janice, "and some crystal wash, if you have it."
The magic cleaning fluid was more expensive than a shower, but Sophie kept ending up drenched in blood. She knew Jory produced some to sell at the Adventure Society Trade Hall.
"All out of crystal wash, I'm afraid," Janice said. "Mr. Asano keeps buying it all. He's very particular about cleanliness. He says there is tiny dirt that you can't see, but can make you sick. Sounds like nonsense to me, but Mr. Tillman says he's right, so there you have it." "Who is this guy?" Belinda asked. "Another alchemist?" "No, he's training to be an adventurer," Janice said. "He's always out back, lifting weights or meditating. He just pops in every once in a while to cure everyone lined up. Does it for free, too, with his abilities."
"For free?"
"For free,"
Janice confirmed.
"Doesn't that hurt Jory's business?"
"Oh, he never makes much money off the clinic anyway," Janice said. "Mostly he sells things at the trade hall, or even takes the occasional adventuring contract. That's where he is today."
"So what does this Asano get out of it, if he's working for free?" Belinda asked. "Doesn't that seem a bit suspect to you?"
"No, Mr. Asano isn't like that," Janice said. "He says it lets him practice his healing ability, and he is always practicing so hard. But really, I think he just likes helping people."
"Still sounds suspicious to me."
"Oh, you wouldn't think so if you got to know him," Janice said. "It's also good that Mr. Tillman has a friend. He used to spend all his time upstairs with his little experiments."
"Still, keep an eye on him," Belinda said. "You should never trust people who say they just want to help."
Chapter 52 Pain.
"I'm taking it up to 5.
Rufus's voice echoed through the Mirage Chamber. Jason stood waiting in his illusionary body. He was under the dome, but it was hidden by the false landscape. His senses told him he was standing on a desert hillside, ancient ruins all around him, and dead enemies at his feet. The Mirage Chamber was a strange experience. To Jason's senses, everything was real, including himself. He felt the impact of every blow and the pain of every wound, even as his body lay unharmed in the control room. The wounds vanished from Jason's body, and the fallen enemies around him vanished. In their place, 5 men appeared and immediately jumped to the attack. Jason's new art was different in many ways from what he had expected, although in hindsight such differences were obvious. In his own world, martial arts were designed to fight other humans, operating within a fixed range of physical capability. Adventurers had to fight anything, from people with superhuman attributes to shark crabs to spiders the size of a delivery van. It was tricky to put a wrist lock on something that didn't have a wrist. The Way of the Reaper consisted of 5 forms, which shifted the combat style's priorities to meet changing circumstances. They were not organized to confront specific challenges, but rather to meet challenges in specific ways. The form Way of the Sage, for example, was the most mobile of the 5 stances. It was of equal use against multiple opponents in complicated terrain, as it was against a giant creature with many legs. The Way of the Hierophant form was direct and aggressive, while the Way of the Trickster was the exact opposite,
full of strange movements and unconventional attacks, it reminded Jason of drunken boxing. The way of the hunter offered debilitating attacks against the unaware victims, and methods to hone in on the weak point of a monster. Against human opponents, the way of the hermit put attackers off balance to set up devastating counters. Against monsters, it was used to defend against unusual attacks from the most bizarre creatures. Altogether, it made for a comprehensive style, incorporating strikes, grapples, even acrobatics, how to move quickly and quietly, or with swift, breakneck efficiency. All the things he had been learning came into play, from Rufus's footwork to Gary's movement training, even Farah's situational awareness techniques. Despite all of that, Rufus's proclamations about the nature of fighting came to pass. The result of his sudden martial skill reminded Jason of playing a video game for the first time. His avatar may have an array of amazing abilities, but his fumbling efforts to use them left him beaten, battered, and failing to live up to the potential. Boxed in by the five illusionary enemies, he was pinned down and savagely beaten. Rufus took longer to end the simulation than Jason would have liked, but eventually he did, and Jason woke up in his real body. He swung his legs off the platform he was laying on, letting out a groan as he rubbed his side. "I swear I can still feel it," he said. "Phantom pain," Rufus said. "You get used to it." "Five enemies was a little much," Jason said. "I could barely handle four." "You want to go back down?" "No, the challenge is good." "That's what I want to hear." "Still, better five illusionary goons than one of Humphrey," Jason said. "I'd call him a monster, but I've fought monsters. He's worse." "Humphrey has been training since he was able to walk upright," Rufus said. "He and I have that in common. A book won't close that gap overnight." "That's fair. What did your parents teach you when you were growing up?" "My dad's parents came from another country," Jason said. "My mum was very big on having us learn about it, the language, the culture. Dad himself couldn't care less, and I was the same. It was really my brother's thing." "Well," Rufus said, "you can speak the language now." Jason tilted his head thoughtfully. "Huh, I guess I can." Jason and Rufus left the Mirage Chamber and started back for the city. Rufus asking about his family had left him uncharacteristically quiet. Jason didn't have a lot of contact with his family after they had fallen out. When he had dropped out of university, he didn't move back from Melbourne. The only ones he saw regularly were his much older sister, along with her husband and daughter. Uncle Jason was the cheapest childcare in town, but for all his complaining, he loved that little girl. From literally a world away, conflicts that once seemed intractable now looked small and meaningless. As they made their way from the grounds of the Geller estate, Rufus looked over at Jason, locked in contemplation. He wasn't used to be the one making conversation. "How are your essence abilities coming along?" Rufus asked. "What? Oh, good, yeah," Jason said. "I'm getting better with the shadow teleport. I've been testing its limitations." "Oh?" "It needs a distinct shadow," Jason explained. "I can't just teleport around wherever I like in the dark."
"So you need at least some light."
"Yeah," Jason said. "But I have a solution for that. Shadow jumping isn't the only ability I've been working on."
"Good," Rufus said. "Mastering your essence abilities is crucial. What have you learned?"
Jason stopped and looked around. They were on a wide path through a grove of what looked like banyan trees. Like most of the Geller estate's winding pathways, the vegetation shaded the path from the punishing sun.
"This'll work," Jason said.
"You remember how my cloak can light up with stars?"
"I do. Watch this."
Jason's shadowy cloak appeared around him like dark smoke. Stars started to appear upon it, lighting it up as Rufus had seen in the past. Then the stars floated off the cloak, more and more of them, drifting out, spreading their cool light under the shady trees. The lights weren't overpowering, filling the area with shadowy nooks and crannies. Jason started moving around, but the star motes didn't move with him, floating independently.
"So you can bring your own shadows," Rufus said.
That's the idea, Jason said. I've been practicing at night. Once I have it down, I should be a proper menace in the dark.
Well, keep at it, Rufus said. Ideally, you will have solid control of your abilities for the Adventure Society assessment. It's only a couple of weeks away now.
I don't know, Jason said. I've come so far since I was stumbling around that hedge maze with no pants, but it feels like there's still so much further to go.
The only thing you can do with that feeling, Rufus said, is to get used to it. I've been going through one form of training or another for as long as I can remember, and I still feel like that.
The interior of Lucian Lamprey's viewing box was spacious and split into two levels. Behind Lucian's heavy wooden desk, on the smaller but higher back level, was the luxurious chair in which he spent most of his day. The larger space was a relaxed lounging area, with plush chairs and a comfortable couch. They were arrayed in a semicircle around the viewing window, with a low refreshments table in the middle. Lucian had descended from his usual perch as a gesture to his visitor, awaiting her in one of the soft chairs in the viewing lounge. Respect was not the same as deference, however, and he didn't stand as he waved her to another of the chairs. The director of the Magic Society did not stand up to meet a crime lord.
"Thank you for your kind invitation," Clarissa Ventress said.
Her bodyguard, Darnell, remained outside the door. He rarely was away from her side, but Ventress was at a rare disadvantage. The fortress was the symbol of power in Old City, and she was one of its rulers. In front of Lucian Lamprey, however, she was reminded that Old City's power was only hers so long as the island had no interest in taking it from her. Lucian Lamprey represented both danger and opportunity.
"You have been the fortress's most important patron for some time now," Ventress said. "I'm delighted you've given me the privilege of a meeting."
Lucian nakedly ran his eyes over Clarissa. He could sense her bronze rank aura, see the body sculpted into life perfection by the magic of her essences. She wore an exquisite green dress that both commanded and provoked. Lucian had heard the Delta contained several breeds of snake that were beautiful in their coloration but deadly to encounter. He had the same impression of Clarissa Ventress.
"The pleasure is genuinely mine," he told her.
Lucian's assistant Cassowary brought refreshments, setting them on the table as Lucian and Clarissa exchanged more niceties.
"As you may be aware," Lucian said, "I am an enthusiast of the fights here in the fortress."
"I have heard as such," Clarissa said.
"Normally it's the evening battles that interest me, fighters with a full set of essences. But lately, I have found one of the lower card fighters to be highly compelling. One of your fighters."
Clarissa smiled. The key to controlling a person was finding what they wanted. Now she understood what Lucian wanted, her concerns melted away.
"The Nightingale," she said.
It was hardly a leap of deduction. A certain kind of man took perverse pleasure in breaking the will of a strong woman. It was the reason Sophie made such a useful stick with which to prod Cole Silver. Clarissa enjoyed such men. She found them weak and easy to handle.
"Her real name is Sophie Wexler," Clarissa said. "She came into my employ under the condition that I would protect her."
"Give her to me."
"Of course, I would like to do nothing else," Clarissa said. "But there are complications."
Lucian scowled.
"You must understand," Clarissa said, "that my deal to protect her is widely known. That knowledge is no small part of where the protection comes from. I have gotten where I am on the strength of my reputation. If I make a deal to protect a person, then hand them over to someone else, I am no longer able to vouchsafe any agreement on the strength of my word alone."
"And if I just decide to take her?"
"Then no one in Old City could stop you," Clarissa said. "But if Old City was all you had to worry about, you already would have."
The director of the Magic Society can't just go around kidnapping women for his own pleasure, and that kind of thing has a way of getting around. What you need is to have her placed under your power in such a way that will not be given a second glance.
Go on, Lucian said.
I think, perhaps, Clarissa said, there is a way in which we can have both of our needs met. It will take some effort on my part, but the conclusion should be mutually satisfying.
Explain, Lucian demanded.
You must understand that one's word is not something that can be repaired. Once broken, it stays broken. I made an agreement to protect the girl from external influences in return for certain services. Should something befall her in the course of providing those services, I cannot be expected to protect her from herself. You may or may not be aware, but she is a professional thief. If she were caught through lack of ability in her chosen trade, then I could hardly be blamed. Once she was in the hands of the legal system, I have no doubt a man of such staggering influence as yourself could take charge of the matter from there.
I do believe I could, Lucian said, thoughtfully. But can you get her there?
It will require me to take some pains, Clarissa said. But what's a little pain in service to a man such as yourself?
Chapter 53 Nightlife. With Jason's Adventure Society field assessment looming closer by the day, Rufus, Gary, and Farah pushed him harder than ever. As a release, they would spend their evenings exploring the nighttime entertainments offered by the city. Danielle Geller acted as their guide to local society, usually with her son, Humphrey, in tow. The symphony was a revelation to Jason. The concert hall was situated in the Guild District, conveniently close to their lodgings, and they enjoyed the view from the Gellers' private viewing box. The instruments weren't any he recognized, although many were similar, at least in appearance. It was the magic they contained that made the performance as magnificent visually as it was musically. As they played, dancing streamers of light rose up from the instruments, galloping out over the audience to frolic in consonance with the music. Harmony of light and sound came together to transfigure the performance into something unlike any Jason had experienced before.
How often do they put this on?
Jason leaned over to ask Danielle.
The full symphony. Once per month, although smaller performances happen all through the week.
Is there a membership or something I can get?
There's a patronage program with the Musical Society, Danielle said. I can introduce you to some people from the Musical Society if that is of interest to you.
Please and thank you.
At an evening of ballroom dancing, they encountered the young acolyte of knowledge, Gabrielle Pellin.
Fancy that, Danielle said innocently.
When Humphrey failed to muster up the courage for an approach, he was left watching in horror as Jason taught her a dance from his own world. After Jason slipped the string quartet a few coins, they claimed the floor to demonstrate it in full, to the applause of the gathering. Afterwards, Jason escorted her in the direction of Humphrey, Danielle, and Jason's friends.
You're quite the spirited dancer,
Gabrielle told Jason, as they walked leisurely around the dance floor.
You never did tell me the name.
It's called the tango, Jason said.
Is it well known in your world?
It's probably the most famous dance there is. It was my older sister who taught me to dance. I wasn't very interested until my father gave me some sage advice. He told me that if I wanted to be successful in love, I needed to learn three things. How to dance, how to cook, and how to keep my damn mouth shut.
How did that work out?
Well, Jason said, I can dance and I can cook. Gabrielle, you'll remember Humphrey Geller.
Of course, she said. I haven't assessed that many people for the Adventure Society, but of those I have, I think he may have been the most talented.
you realize you assessed me right after.
I do, she said, primly.
Ouch, Jason said, turning his gaze to Humphrey. It seems this rose still has her thorns. Humphrey, I think I'll leave this next dance to you. They both looked to Humphrey, who was looking nervous. His sheepish embarrassment could not hide the broad shoulders and chiseled features, however. He was another in a long line of annoyingly attractive people Jason was getting to know.
I think that would be delightful, Gabrielle said, taking mercy on him.
What do you say, Humphrey? Jason asked.
That you...
I would like that very much. Unlike most society hotspots, the theatre district was actually located in Old City, quite close to the fortress. It allowed members of high society to seem like they were heading to a play instead of the less savoury delights of the city's chief den of iniquity. Leaving a private viewing box, Jason and his companions discussed their opinions of the play.
The stage combat was actually rather impressive, Rufus said. I found the plot to be a little slight, however. I like a performance with something to say.
It did have something to say, Gary said. That sword fights are great. The good guys win, the bad guys lose. The end. I liked it.
Jason was shaking his head.
You disagree? Danielle asked him.
I'm probably just misreading it because of the difference in culture, Jason said. It's not like you to be diplomatic, Rufus said. Just say what you really think.
I think it did have something to say, Jason said. I think the main characters weren't the heroes, they were the villains. I think the whole play was a critique of hereditary power structures, and by overcoming the antagonists, the central characters were restoring a state of oppression.
You think the main characters were the villains? Rufus asked.
I do.
I don't see it, Rufus said.
Don't you have a childhood friend who's a member of some royal family? Jason asked.
He does, Farrah said.
What does that have to do with anything? Rufus asked.
They exited the theatre through the doors reserved for private box holders, where members of society were boarding their carriages. Jason noticed a woman with the same silver rank aura and physical perfection of Danielle. She broke away from her own group of ladies, making a beeline for Danielle.
Danielle, the woman greeted. Always lovely to see you, young Master Humphrey, and you must be Rufus Remore. With your erstwhile companions, of course.
Lady Thalia Mercer,
Danielle introduced the lady. Thalia's eyes settled on Jason.
We haven't had the pleasure, she said. You must be the young man people are getting so curious about.
I'm no one important, Jason said.
Yet you keep important company, Thalia said.
I do? He asked. I don't really know these people. I'm only here because I won a raffle. Farrah snorted a laugh, while Rufus ran an exasperated hand over his face.
Wait, there was a raffle?
Gary asked, only to be shushed by Farrah.
This is Jason Asano, Danielle introduced, a smile playing over her lips. He will be taking his field assessment for the Adventure Society when Humphrey retakes his. I assume your son will be there as well?
He will, Thalia said, unhappily. I tried to convince my husband that Thadwick would benefit from additional training, but he was quite adamant.
Thalia turned to Rufus, the man who had failed her son during the previous assessment.
You know, Mr. Remore, she said, you rather overturned the fruit cart with how you conducted the last assessment.
I'm sorry if you feel your son was treated unfairly, Rufus said. But since he had previously passed, perhaps it would have been better not to put him forwards for reassessment.
Thalia laughed.
I couldn't agree more, Thalia said, to Rufus's surprise. However, my husband cannot seem to help poking his fingers into things best left alone.
It's a shame you weren't here when Thalia's daughter was tested, Danielle said.
Thalia oversaw her training personally, and I have no doubt she would have passed. Where is Cassandra this evening?
Out in the Delta somewhere, on a contract, Thalia said. I do look forwards to introducing you, Mr. Ramore.
After some more niceties, Thalia excused herself and the group boarded the Geller family carriage. It was one of the ones drawn by magic rather than animals, and was larger than the equivalents from Jason's own world.
I do believe Thalia is trying to set you up with her daughter, Danielle told Rufus.
He's used to it, Farrah said.
If she's anything like her brother, Rufus said, I'd rather she didn't. I've never seen anyone that incompetent undertake a field assessment before. I'm convinced the other members of his group passed because they honed their abilities, covering for that idiot. It was to the point that it could be a whole new training methodology. The trick would be finding people so aggressively incapable.
You'll find her daughter to be a very different prospect, Danielle said. Cassandra is a remarkable woman, and right about your age. Actually, she rather reminds me of Jason.
You're kidding, Rufus said.
Oh, at a glance they seem different, Danielle said. She's more of a knife to Jason's hammer, but they both seem to enjoy provocation as a social tool.
On second thought, Rufus said, looking warily at Jason, I might prefer to deal with the brother.
Sophie and Belinda were summoned to Clarissa Ventress's home instead of the fortress. It was a sprawling manor in Old City's Canal District. The Canal District had its own internal city wall. It was a legacy of time before the island, when the district was home to the city elite. It had been left to those who had wealth but lacked in prestige, preferring to stand tall in Old City than go underfoot on the island. The two women were led through the compound, past various thugs standing guard. Centuries ago, Clarissa's residence had been the seat of the Mercer family. The grounds were quite expansive, with more than one canal flowing through it. Inside the house itself, they were guided by Clarissa's hulking Leonid bodyguard, Darnell. Clarissa was waiting for them in a parlor, sitting at a table with morning tea set out. Hers was the only seat in the room.
Ladies, she greeted them. I have good news for you.
I don't suppose it's that Sophie's done with the fighting pits, Belinda said sullenly.
Actually, it is, Clarissa said.
Sophie and Belinda both looked up sharply.
Really?
Belinda asked.
Yes, Clarissa said. She's had her last pit fight.
Then what is it you want me doing next?
Sophie asked, eyes narrowing as she looked at Clarissa.
So cynical, Clarissa said. Just say it, Sophie said. You two were an excellent team, Clarissa said. I suspect that even now the two of you are the only ones who know exactly how many jobs you pulled off for Old Man Silver. I just want you back to doing what you do best.
The deal was that we help you provoke Silver, Sophie said. Now you want us to steal from him.
Of course not, Clarissa said. I would never put you in that position.
Then what? Sophie demanded.
It is well known that for almost a decade now, the Silver family has enjoyed the services of a pair of excellent thieves. When those same thieves start robbing the social elite right out in public, the pressure on Silver will be considerable.
Are you crazy?
Belinda yelled, stepping angrily forward. The bodyguard moved towards her, but Clarissa casually waved him back.
This will be the last task I assign you, Clarissa said. Naturally, stealing from Greenstone's wealthiest will get adventurers investigating. Once they realize that the Silver family's most capable thieves are the most likely culprits, the pressure on Silver will be immense. Are you really willing to risk bringing the powers from the island down on your own head?
Sophie asked.
It's hardly a risk, Clarissa said.
What they'll find is that after conducting a series of expertly carried out robberies, the thieves who have worked for the Silver family for years are no longer in the city, because, having met your end of the deal, you will be far from here, as promised, with a goodly amount of money for your troubles.
Belinda opened her mouth to snap back a response, but was silenced by a gesture from Sophie.
All right,
Sophie said. Belinda wrenched her head to look at Sophie as if she'd lost her mind. Sophie gave a slight shake of the head to keep her silent.
Excellent, Clarissa said. Now, your first target...
No, Sophie interrupted.
Excuse me?
Clarissa asked.
The goal is to draw attention down on Silver, Sophie said, not to undertake any specific robbery. So it doesn't matter what we take, or from who, so long as it's high profile and it's public. Belinda and I will choose the targets and the timing.
Choosing the targets, Clarissa said, means I can meet more than one objective at a time.
Our deal didn't include any additional objectives you may have, Sophie said, so you can sort them out yourself. You aren't staking us out as bait for some other reason, are you?
Of course not, Clarissa said.
Then we choose the targets and we choose the timing.
Fine, Clarissa conceded. Just make sure I'm notified beforehand.
No. We'll keep you out of it, Sophie said. We wouldn't want people moving attention from Silver to you, after all. We plan and execute the robberies alone, and we fence the goods through Silver's people. We have connections enough for that.
Clarissa's mouth was smiling, but her eyes were spraying venom.
Very well, she said, but I want jobs done quickly and repeatedly. If not, then you aren't holding up your end, and there won't be a place in this city you can hide from me. As for escaping it, if you could leave this city alive, then you wouldn't have come to me in the first place.
Sophie gave a curt nod, then strode away. Belinda followed in her wake, Clarissa's bodyguard trailing them until they were out of the compound. They walked through the darkened streets of Old City at a rapid stride.
What was that?
Belinda angrily demanded, once she was sure they had cleared Clarissa's eyes and ears.
That whole thing makes no sense. Everything hinges on people figuring out that we're the thieves, and stirring up trouble with the island people. They'll send adventurers after us. Is she trying to bring all that down on her own head?
You're right, Sophie said. It doesn't make sense if this is still about provoking Silver. Something's changed, and somehow island politics are involved. Ventress wouldn't risk provoking the island unless she has some kind of backing to shield her.
This whole plan is madness, Belinda said.
Yes, Sophie agreed.
Then why go along with it? She has to know how transparent she's being.
You know how Ventress is about her reputation. She wants us to break the deal, even if everyone knows she pushed us into it.
Why bother?
Belinda asked.
We aren't any use to her, except as a stick to poke Silver with.
I don't know, Sophie said. Maybe she's looking for an excuse to hand us over to him. Whatever she's into now, we've somehow become leverage. But she can't be seen breaking the deal.
Her vaunted reputation.
If we break the deal, she can openly do whatever she wants with us.
So you bought us as much time and freedom as you could,
Belinda realized.
We need to figure out our next move. Ventress is no longer our way out of the city.
Dorgan?
Belinda suggested. The third member of the Big Three had been quiet since the death of Old Man Silver.
We don't have anything to trade for protection.
Then what? Belinda asked. Try and make our own way out?
The reason they had gone to Clarissa in the first place was that escaping the city unnoticed by the Big Three was as good as impossible. They had an iron grip of the shipping trade, and there was very little overland travel.
We may have to try the overland route, Sophie said.
Escaping the Greenstone region overland meant one of two routes. The first was to go upriver to the Mistrun Oasis, then keep going through the desert to the Central Veldt. From there, south, to the more fertile lands and a port where the Big Three still had interests enough that they could easily be dragged back to Greenstone. The other way was to make for the Northern Territories, which meant crossing the Dead Sands, braving monsters and nomadic bandit tribes.
"We ruled that out for a reason," Belinda said. "Our experience and expertise end at the city wall. If we try the wilderness, it's a pure gamble."
"A gamble may be all we have," Sophie said. "For now, we do enough to keep Ventress mollified while we figure it out." Belinda hung her head.
"Things just keep getting worse,"
she said softly.
"I know."
Chapter 54 Field Assessment. The layout of the Adventure Society campus reminded Jason of a university. One of the nice ones, with expanses of lawn, gardens, and tiled pathways leading through impressive stone arches. The marshalling yard was like a small town square for larger expeditions to assemble. When Humphrey and Jason arrived together, a dozen people were already waiting. An entitled walking cliché broke out of the group to sneer at Humphrey. "Here he is," the young man said, "the pride of the Geller family. But that out-of-town prick failed you, just like the rest of us." Like everyone other than Jason himself, the person approaching them was somewhere in his mid to late teens. This made the assemblage of would-be adventurers young men and women, but Jason could only think of the sneering idiot as a boy.
"We all have areas in which we can improve," Humphrey said. "There's no shame in admitting that."
"Shouldn't your hair be more oily?" Jason asked.
"What?"
the boy asked, turning from Humphrey to Jason as if surprised to see him there.
"Your hair," Jason said, pointing.
"When the sneering idiot who will inevitably be humiliated comes out to do his sneering, his hair should be properly greased back. Clearly you've overdone it with whatever goo you put in there, but I really feel like you could have slathered in some more."
"Who are you?"
the boy asked. He was looking at Jason with the same expression he'd give to furniture that unexpectedly started talking.
"I'm no one important," Jason said.
"Clearly," the boy said. "Do you have any idea who my father is?"
"Does anyone?" Jason asked. "Your mother's a friendly woman."
Humphrey winced, while the onlookers all looked shocked, none more so than the boy himself.
"Are you looking to die?" the boy asked.
"Is your father going to kill me?" Jason asked. "You don't strike me as someone who fights his own battles."
Jason? Humphrey interjected. "That's Thadwick Mercer. His father actually might kill you."
"You're Thadwick Mercer?"
"That's right. Feel like apologizing now?"
"I do, actually," Jason said. "I shouldn't have said that about your mother. I have neither the knowledge nor the right to criticize how she conducts her personal affairs, and I apologize unreservedly. I only met her briefly, but she struck me as a woman of style and intelligence. Now I've met you, I can see why people wonder how you turned out this way."
"What?"
Thadwick asked.
"It was actually the first thing I heard about you," Jason said. "What was it Rufus said, Humphrey? The most incompetent person he'd ever seen attempt to join the Adventure Society. And Rufus grew up in a school, so he's seen the bottom end of a lot of classes."
"I'm going to destroy you, you no-name little prick," Thadwick spat. "I'm going to scrape you off my shoe."
"Is that a challenge?" Jason asked. "Like a duel or something? How do you want to do it? Dance off or your mama fight? I'd prefer a dance off because I actually like your mother. Also, I've got the moves."
"What?"
"You say that a lot," Jason said. "And you always look kind of confused. You're not the sharpest tool in the shed, are you?" Thadwick raised a hand at Jason, electricity crackling over it.
"That's enough," a voice bellowed.
Everyone turned to see a man wearing an Adventure Society pin approaching the group. Jason had never seen Vincent Trenslow before, although Rufus had described his glorious mustache. As promised, it extended past either side of his head. Behind Vincent was another official that Jason did recognize, as did Humphrey. It was Guy, the official present at their Adventure Society intake.
Mercer!
Vincent barked.
If I see you try to use an ability on a fellow candidate again, you will fail on the spot. And you? Asano, is it? I suggest you clamp that mouth shut before someone puts a fist through it, which will be recorded in my report as a self-inflicted injury. Geller, do try and keep your friend in check.
Yes, sir, Humphrey said.
Thadwick flashed an insolent look, but remained silent. Jason was barely listening, transfixed by the man's moustache. Rufus had spent a week working closely with Vincent Trenslow during the last field assessment. After hearing Vincent would be taking Jason's assessment, Rufus told Jason what he could anticipate. There may be some level of corruption in this branch of the Adventure Society, Rufus had told him. But Vincent Trenslow is exactly what I expect from a society official. I know you have your own ways of showing respect, but try and use mine for once. Humphrey Geller will be there, so follow his lead. Jason respected Rufus's judgment and intended to do his best, while acknowledging his best wasn't that great. He also recognized that Rufus had very much undersold the magnificence of the man's moustache. Vincent explained the procedure for the Adventure Society field assessment. The group would depart for 1 week, during which time the candidates would attempt to complete postings from the adventure boards in towns and villages of the Delta.
For the duration of this assessment, Vincent said, you may refer to me as Instructor Trenslow, and my fellow official as Instructor Spaulding. For the second month in a row, we have extended numbers. We are taking a different approach this month and splitting the group in two.
The other official, Guy, stepped forward.
Last month there were problems finding enough postings for everyone on the notice boards, Guy said. Therefore, the groups will be assessed separately, taking different routes through the Delta.
There weren't enough monsters last month?
Jason whispered at Humphrey.
There were plenty,
Humphrey whispered back.
Watch how they split the groups.
Jason spotted that, while he hid it well enough, Vincent had a hint of disdain around the eyes as Guy divided the group.
My group, Guy said, will consist of those who have passed the assessment before, but their records were lost. I'll be administering a specially tailored program of reassessment for all of you that takes into account past achievement.
And now you see it, Humphrey said softly.
Yes, I do. Jason agreed.
There were 17 candidates, 10 of which went off with Guy for their special assessment. The remaining 7 followed Vincent.
So that's how the society came down, Jason said. The people who weaseled their way off the books weasel their way back on, while the rest of us pass an actual test.
Mr. Asano, Vincent called out sharply. If and when you have passed this test and become a member of the Adventure Society, you can comment on how the society conducts itself as much as you like. For the next week, however, you are a worthless flesh sack nestled vulnerably in the palm of my hand. It would serve you well to disincline me at every opportunity from wanting to make a fist.
Yes, sir, Jason said.
Travel through the Delta was mostly along the raised embankment roads. The group travelled in the back of an animal-drawn wagon, which didn't sit well with everyone. They were from wealthy and privileged families, unused to such rough treatment. A few complained loudly until browbeaten by Vincent, after which they restricted themselves to unhappy muttering. Others followed Humphrey's lead and took the conditions in stride. Walking along a narrow embankment road, Jason glanced at Vincent, then at Humphrey. Both had crystals floating over their heads. The one over Vincent was silver-grey, while Humphrey's was a glowing blue.
"What's with the crystals?" Jason asked.
"Should I have gotten a crystal from somewhere?"
My crystal isn't a magic item, Humphrey said. It's an essence ability that restores my mana. The one Vincent has is a recording crystal. You haven't seen them before.
I haven't, Jason said.
What do they record?
An image of whatever is in front of them, plus whatever they can hear, Humphrey said. He's recording everything for later assessment. After the last time, Mr. Ramore took me through all the things I did wrong, in excruciating detail. He kept playing them over and over.
Where would I get something like that?
The Magic Society makes them, Humphrey said. They sell them at the markets on the island, and at a few stores in the Guild District. You can get them at the Trade Hall in the Adventure Society too, assuming you pass and are allowed in.
The group was walking through an expanse of leafy, knee-high plants when Vincent quietly called for a stop. The plants were some kind of crop Jason wasn't familiar with, divided into fields by bamboo fencing. Vincent pulled out another crystal and tossed it into the air in front of him, where it started floating. In front of it, an image shimmered into being, and Jason realized this new crystal worked like a telescope. It showed a distant part of the sprawling fields, where a pack of rodent-like monsters were gorging themselves on the crop. The monsters were half as tall as a human, but looked like oversized mice. They stood on their hind legs, hunching forward. Instead of forelegs, they had long arms that ended in eerily human-like hands. They used them to pluck leaves and stuff them into their mouths.
Rattlings, Vincent said. 13 of them. They'll run rather than fight, and if they reach their burrows, that'll be it. They won't surface again until they go berserk, at which point it won't be crops they're after.
Vincent turned to look at Humphrey.
Mr. Geller, the only reason you failed last time was that you lacked decisiveness. So long as you can show me you've learned something in the last month, you're the easiest pass in this group. Can you get all 13?
Yes, sir, Humphrey said without hesitation.
You're sure?
Yes, sir.
Prove it.
Jason watched as scaly wings appeared out of thin air on Humphrey's back. He brought them towards the ground, pushing him into the air. The dragon wings sent him surging away at a rapid pace. Humphrey's familiar, which had been sitting on his shoulder in the form of a bird, flew after him.
Wow,
Jason said. Jason and Humphrey had trained together several times over the last month. They had focused on martial technique, so each was yet to see all the other's essence abilities. Humphrey's martial art was called the Surging Storm style, an explosive and unrelenting combat art that was completely at odds with Humphrey's personality. Thus far, Jason's skill book-derived technique hadn't come close to matching it. The group watched Humphrey climb higher into the air as he grew smaller with distance. Suddenly he plunged out of the sky, and all eyes snapped to the magnified image in front of Vincent. They saw Humphrey crash into the monsters like a meteor, a huge sword in the shape of a dragon's wing appearing in his hands. He came down like a meteor, his boots landing on one monster and his sword on another. They died in a single gruesome instant. The other rattlings let out panicked screeches while Humphrey swung the huge sword in a low horizontal arc. It plowed through the monsters as if they weren't there, severing three clean in half with a single swing. The rattling scattered, but instead of chasing, Humphrey dropped his sword, which vanished into the air. He took a deep breath, then a stream of fire sprayed out of his mouth like a human flamethrower. He walked the burning line over the fleeing rattlings, torching crops and monsters alike. Three rattlings escaped the flames, having run at different angles to the main cluster. One was being harried by Humphrey's familiar, which had turned into some kind of predatory cat, around the same size as the rattling. The other two were sprinting away in different directions. Humphrey's wings had vanished after he landed, but they reappeared briefly to fling him forwards through the air. They only appeared for a moment, in which they hurled him faster than he had been flying earlier. Another sword appeared in his hand, this one smaller, with a blade made up of metal feathers. He brought it down on a fleeing rattling as he landed, cutting it down with one strike. He vanished from the spot he was standing, reappearing in the path of the final rattling. His sword was held out in front of him, and the startled rattling ran straight onto it. Humphrey yanked the blade up, spraying blood
as the monster fell dead.
He got teleport,
one of the candidates next to Jason said as they watched Humphrey through the magnified image.
I bet they paid a lot for that awakening stone.
Humphrey glanced over to his familiar, who was sitting proudly next to a rattling, dead at his feet. As soon as it saw Humphrey notice it, it transformed into a dog and bounded over for Humphrey to scratch behind its ear. Humphrey walked back to the group through the field, his body drenched in monster blood. The others gave him a wide berth, except for Jason. You all right? Jason asked. He knew Humphrey had killed monsters as part of his training, but he also knew Humphrey was a kind man. Violence didn't come naturally to him. Humphrey nodded. His normally friendly smile was macabre on his bloody face.
That's what I like about you, Jason, he said. You don't pretend that what we do doesn't affect us.
I don't think being numb to it all makes you strong, Jason said. Strong is accepting the choices you make and owning up to the consequences. Like Jason, Humphrey had a dimensional storage space, from which he took a bottle of clear liquid and tipped it over his head. The crystal wash flowed over him, eliminating every trace of blood and filth.
I'd like to be strong like that, Humphrey said.
You know, Jason, sometimes it's like you're from another world.
Jason had long ago realized that Danielle had figured him out, not realizing she hadn't shared it with Humphrey. He decided to tell his friend all about it when they had the time. For now, they were surrounded by other people. Vincent looked Humphrey over, now clean, the crystal wash rapidly evaporating.
You got them all? Vincent said.
Yes, sir, Humphrey said. Burned a good portion of a farmer's crop, though.
I thought the farmer would rather lose some harvest now than family later, Humphrey said. I made a choice.
Yes, you did, Vincent said, putting a hand on Humphrey's shoulder. Good job.
Chapter 55 Rune Tortoise. The routine for the field assessment was to stop in a town or village each night. In the morning, they would collect monster notices from the adventuring board and set out to deal with them. Vincent took an approach where the would-be adventurers who met his standards were no longer called on for the monster hunts. Starting with Humphrey, the first 3 days saw 4 of the 7 candidates move from